It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 653 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week we explore the Illuminatus Trilogy, written in the 1970s by Robert Shea and Robert Anton Wilson. It's being adapted into Tales of Illuminatus, a new comic book series written and illustrated by New Jersey comic book writer and artist Bobby Campbell, who I talked with this week. He put together this series with the assistance of another comic artist, Todd Purse, and the adaptation is being made with the permission of the estates for both Wilson and Shea. There's a Kickstarter project going on right now for it, and you can go there and order the first book of the series, which will be published on paper and digitally on September 14. It's also being published as a free serial on the internet website talesofilluminatus.com. We discuss who the creators and characters are, how this book came to be, and what we can expect from Bobby in the months ahead. Be sure to support this crowdfunding project before it concludes on Friday, August 23 at 11:43 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what Bobby has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. This is the original conspiracy adventure, before the X-Files, before the Da Vinci Code, before True Detective, there was Illuminatus. And for those perhaps still uninitiated into the secret society of illuminated seers, Tales of Illuminatus is the official comic book adaptation of Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea's classic underground trilogy of novels. And I'm talking right now with Bobby Campbell. You're the writer on this, right, Bobby?
Writer and artist. We also have Todd Purse, who's doing his own section that he's writing and drawing as well. So we're kind of splitting the duties between us, both writing and drawing.
All right. Before I get too far involved, people always get mad at me because I don't say this soon enough. It's on Kickstarter, yep. And it is, let me get that, Tales of Illuminatus, number one, The Hidden Light. This project will only be funded if it reaches its goal by Friday, August 23rd at 11:43 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And as we're talking, congratulations are in order. You have already met your $2,300 goal.
Yeah, yes, indeed. We hit it yesterday. We were very, very fortunate.
That's great. That's great. Now, of course, August 23rd is still a little ways off. Don't wait until, of course, that date. I always tell people because people tend to, especially if you hit your goal already, they tend to go, oh, I don't have to worry about that. I'll worry about it when it gets closer. But if you're like any Kickstarter person I know, you go log on and refresh to see if anybody has bid in the last minute or two. And so we don't want you to have to do that all the time, see what's going on with there. Of course, now that you passed it, that's a good place to be. Let's see. I was talking with you before we started to record something that intrigued me about this. And you can probably explain the whole business. I was fascinated that the two creators were actually working at Playboy at the time. That intrigued me.
Yeah, and actually, so the idea for the novel kind of came out of what they were experiencing as editors of a letter column in Playboy. I don't think they were doing the Playboy forum. I think they were, I forget which one they were doing, but it was the one where it was more like political and philosophical conversation. It wasn't like people writing in dirty stories, like that kind of thing. And so what they were getting a lot of letters from conspiracy theorists, a lot of people who had a lot of wild ideas about what was responsible for the wave of assassinations. And this was post-Watergate, so it was kind of all that stuff was mixed in there. So they were hearing from all sorts of people who had wild ideas about the political nature of the country at the time. And so, as the legend goes, they were sitting at the bar after work one day, and were like, you know, what if we wrote a novel where all the conspiracy theories were true simultaneously, no matter how contradictory, no matter how weird, no matter how wild, what if they were all true? And okay. that was the starting point.
Okay, that's interesting. And well, you know, because some people tell me that they're running out of conspiracy theories because they keep coming true on them. So I don't know how accurate that was for these guys. Now, Illuminatus, what is that? Is that a person's name? Is that a group name? Because we always talk about the Illuminati. So if it's Illuminatus, is that a group or a person? What is that?
I think it's a way to describe the adventure of reading the book. It's what happens to you as you read the novel, if I had to guess. The word itself doesn't exist in the novel except in a metafictional, self-referential way, because the novel exists within the novel itself. There's a reviewer who's reviewing the novel as it's proceeding and giving it a bad review as they go through the book. So it's left up to your imagination what it actually means. But that's kind of my interpretation of it.
Okay. So they get all these conspiracy theories to themselves and they actually start to put together novels, like three of them apparently. How'd they do that? What did they do? Did they just sit them down and did it turn into a story? Is it like an anthology? How did this work?
So it was originally intended to be just one giant long story. They did not intend for it to be a trilogy. It was not written as a trilogy. It was written as a book length epic. But when Dell was pondering whether or not to publish it, it took them several years to come around to the idea that they should publish it. And one of the concessions that they asked for was to say, you know, so that it wasn't such a financial risk on their part. They asked Shea and Wilson to cut 500 pages from the original manuscript and wow. chop it up into three parts. So that's how it became a trilogy. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I keep going because you're interesting me there. What happened after that?
So, how they composed it, as near as anyone can tell, was they would just pass the manuscript back and forth with each other, and just it became a game of one-upsmanship. So one guy would bang out a bunch of pages and then just send it to the other guy, and he'd pick up from where he left off and just keep it going. And, you know, they would edit each other. They would, try to paint them into the other guy into a corner. So he would have to get real creative to get out of the corner. And another interesting thing, that goes back to the Playboy connection is that they were using Playboy's research staff to do their research for them. They would pretend that it was for something for the magazine, but it was actually for their book. So they would be like, oh, we need to know about this, you know, obscure secret society from the 11th century. Let's have our well-funded research staff get that information for us.
Oh, cool. Well, that makes a lot of sense because if they're sitting there and they may not be quite so busy, hey, why not put them to work? So
absolutely.
Now, this is the first time that this has been in a comic book form, right?
No. Someone tried in the 1990s. I say tried. They succeeded. They completed three issues, and they got enough of the fourth that they did an Ashcan edition that they took around to comic cons for a number of years. And they're wonderful. They're pretty amazing. They're really like in the spirit of black and white underground comics. But it's pretty remarkable what they were able to do. They condensed down that they did a much better job than I've done of condensing it down into less pages. At this point, I think I'm at about a page of comic equals a page of the novel. But they did a great job. I don't know what stalled them out. It's just, you know, how indie comics are. It's very hard to keep things going, but they did a great job.
Well, reality gets in the way of comics sometimes, and they may have run out of money or something like that. So, I'm sure. That happens a lot of the times with people, especially with indie comics, because you don't have, like, Disney behind Marvel or Warner Brothers behind DC or things like that. You've got to come up with your own funding and things like that. And that was the pre-Kickstarter days. So all kinds of
right, things. Absolutely.
So okay, so now you actually interacted with one of the original authors, right?
Correct. I got to know Robert Anton Wilson during the last few years of his life. When he was younger, he had polio, and he was cured of the polio. But years later, in his old age, he had post polio syndrome, which made it hard for him to get around. And so he at that point was a lot of his income was coming from doing lecture tours. And so since he couldn't really get around anymore, he opened up an online academy, like doing online workshops. And so I joined a couple of them and I got to know him through that. And then he let me come out and meet him and hang out at his house. And I got to do, some illustrations for him. And then after he passed away, I developed a relationship with his family and the trust that manages his intellectual property. And so I got to do a bunch of like book covers and interior illustrations, and we've done zines and held events and just, doing everything we can to kind of keep his legacy going. Right before he passed, he sent out a message that was keep the lasagna flying, which everyone interpreted to mean, try to keep the show going. And there's been a huge community of people that have assisted in doing that. And I'm a small part of that. And that's kind of how this all kind of progressed.
So how long have you been doing this as far as like getting to know him and then getting involved with this?
So I met him I first met him online in 2004. Then he passed away in 2007. And ever since then, there's been efforts to keep his work alive and vital. And he's a very well-liked person. He's a very uncontroversial, he's very well regarded. So there's a pretty large goodwill movement towards getting him the due that he deserves. It's kind of like the people he inspired got much more famous than he did himself. And so there's almost kind of like an imbalance that a lot of people are trying to correct in that regard.
That's interesting, because I was at a convention for a sci-fi show called Farscape. And the actors are there, and everybody's crowding the actors, and the creator is sitting at a table by himself, and people would come up to him, try to talk with him, say, you don't want to talk to me, the actors are over there. Until finally,
right.
So many people went to him and said, the audience wants to hear from you. And he was shocked. He actually had to get up on stage and actually talk, which he didn't expect. And I was like, well, see, sometimes I'm more interested in what the creator has to say than an actor. Because you can ask an actor, what's your favorite scene? Well, of course, it's the one that they're in the longest. But if you actually talk with the creator, they'll give you insights into why they did what they did. And that's what I'm always interested in. I guess that kind of...
Absolutely.
Was that part of your interest when you started talking to him?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, and he's also, in addition to writing fiction, he wrote a great deal of like psychological and philosophical material that I found very helpful when I was in my early 20s. And so it was, there was kind of a sense of like trying to get to the source of that, wealth of information that had helped me so much. And I think that's a reason why a lot of people are kind of drawn to his ideas. Cause they tend to find you at vulnerable times. At least that a lot of people have that story of those books finding them in a time of need and being the thing that helped them through a rough time. And so he kind of has that iconic status of being the person that ushered a lot of people through dark times. Hmm. And I think that's why he was such a that's why people were drawn so heavily towards him, I think.
Now, I do want to dive into the book, but before I do that, I got to ask you. On the Kickstarter page, there's something that's called the Tales of Illuminatus Overture by you. Did you actually make music for that?
There is music that goes along with it, but the overture is just, I put together the first 12 pages of the book as a sample. So it's not a literal overture. It's just what I'm calling the first chunk of pages to give people a sense of what the book's going to be like and hopefully entice them to pre-order a copy.
Well, if you click on the illustration, the very first thing you see, of course, there's an arrow. Of course, a lot of Kickstarters do this. There's music as well as you, video of you talking about it. Who made the music? I'm just kind of curious because it's...
Oh, yeah.
Who did the... Did you do that?
I did not do the music. That was my good friend DJ Steve Fly, who created a whole album's worth of music straight out of both the novel and our adaptation. And it's really fun. We've got this project where, so in the book, one of the big sequences in the book is that it's all leading up to this Woodstock style concert in Bavaria. So within the book itself, it just lists, you know, maybe like 100 different band names that are attending this concert. And what Steve did is he's made audio tracks. He's made pop singles from all these bands. So we've been, every week we release another single that's a made up song from one of the bands featured in the book.
Wow. Because I'll actually use one of those. There's the part of the video I'm going to use for the intro to this interview. Because I kind of like that. It's rare when you get a book that has its own theme song. So I like to take advantage of that when I can.
Absolutely. So, yeah. And then we also, my friend Dan Robinson is also recording music to support the comic as well. So we actually have two musicians that have been helping us out to kind of flesh out the world a little bit and make it a little more exciting.
Wow. Well, you guys really are into this good subject. So that's fun to hear. Now, before we dive in, I want to read, there's an intro page that I think helps us know what we're talking about here. It says, the Illuminati, an inside joke, the lunatic fringe, or a hellish conspiracy of psychotic lost souls hidden for centuries, unleashing its evil on a naive, defenseless world. It was Sam Goodman's lousy luck to smell the trail in some underground memos in a bombed-out office, the heavy case he'd always dreaded. So it was one tired New York cop on a wild, weird, zany odyssey searching out a secret society that spans centuries, cross continents, drug generations, and stooped to any depth of degradation to self-destruct an entire world. Can Saul Goodman stop them in time? And if you look at the cover, of course, there are three people particularly identified. The top one is Sam Goodman, who we've talked about. And then there's Barney Muldoon and Greg Dorn. Who are these other guys? Who's Barney Muldoon?
So Barney Muldoon is kind of like the Scully to Saul Goodman's Mulder. He's the other detective who is more skeptical about what they're pursuing. So Saul's the one that's like, you know, immediately jumps to the weird conclusion that leads them on the adventure. And Barney's more of the tentative realist who goes along with the adventure, but he's kind of like the counterbalance. And then we have George Dorn is kind of like your point of view character. He's kind of like, you know, when you have a story that it's a weird world, George Dorn is your guy that gets introduced to this world that the audience gets to live vicariously through. I guess Saul's a little bit that way as well, but I think George Dorn is meant to be the reader's main like entry point into kind of like an initiation into these ideas.
So our perspective.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And then, So Saul and Barney are the archetypal two detectives who are on the trail of the MacGuffin that will drive the plot forward.
Okay. All right. Now on the cover for one, there's a guy standing there with a striped shirt, and he says, "Will you join the Legion of Dynamic Discord in whatever spirit you choose?" And I notice there's a trend going through these things. There's the eye that's on the dollar bill behind his head, and then there's a dolphin behind his left shoulder. Are those things that we see in the books as we go along?
Yes, absolutely. So the character that is inviting the reader to join his conspiracy, that is Hagbard Saleem. He is a pirate who has built himself a giant yellow submarine. And so there's the Illuminati group on the one side. And then on the other side is this Legion of Dynamic Discord, which was part of the kind of the thesis statement of Illuminatus when they were starting it. Was there were these other two guys, Greg Hill and Kerry Thornley, and they had started a complicated joke disguised as a new religion, or a new religion disguised as a complicated joke. Called Discordianism, and the basis of Discordianism is that chaos is the fundamental state of the universe, and that we just project order temporarily upon the primordial chaos. That's their premise. And so the idea with Illuminatus was basically to create a mythology for this joke religion. And so you have a historical basis for the Illuminati organization. And so they thought it would be fun to give the Illuminati an equally ancient antagonist. So you would have that duality. So, and that's the Legion of Dynamic Discord that Hagbard is inviting the reader to join in opposition to the Illuminati.
Okay. Now, yellow submarine, does that mean the Beatles are involved in this?
I mean, it's certainly a reference to it. Yeah, I would say so.
Okay.
Because, I mean, keep in mind, all this stuff, they wrote this book in 1969 to 1971. So that would have been a contemporary reference at that point.
Okay, because I'm intrigued. I want to ask so many questions, but I guess I got to read the book. Like, what does a dolphin got to do with it? I understand the eye. The eye, I knew something about Masons, and Masons believe that's God's eye. It's on the dollar bill and stuff like that But the dolphin, you were going to say something about the dolphin, hopefully?
Oh, sure, yeah. So there, in the novel, Hagbard works with a hyper-intelligent dolphin named Howard, and Howard is able to communicate with Hagbard. And I'm going to guess that the basis of that is the old, like the John Lilly experiments were going on at that time, where it was theorized that we could come to communicate with dolphins. We were learning how intelligent they were and that they had language, and the idea that if they have language, can it be translated? Or can our language be translated to something they understand? And so I think it's playing around with the idea that there are other kinds of intelligence besides human intelligence. And for example, dolphin intelligence. And so you get Howard the dolphin who gives you an entry point into that idea.
Howard the Dolphin, that's funny, because Marvel had a book called Howard the Duck. So
right, yeah.
Close to that. Now, I'm trying to figure out which art did you do and which art did the other person do?
So all the art in the beginning of the book is me. In the video, I show some of Todd's art. And then if you look on the cover, the George Dorn drawing is by Todd. So Todd's handling the George Dorn story. And so that, which doesn't come until the end of the issue one. So that's why it's all my stuff there at the beginning.
Okay. So that's, no, so he does certain segments and you do the rest, right? Is that what I'm understanding?
That is correct. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I just want to be sure. Cause I always like to know who does what. You can tell this is back in the 60s because there's a newspaper machine at one point, and there's a telephone booth with the receiver hanging down and stuff like that. So I get a kick out of all those things. There's a lot of 60s references. You know, there's a peace symbol and the tie-dye shirts and stuff like that all going on in it. So there's all, is the first volume, does it largely take place in the 60s or what?
So it's actually it's a point of mystery when the book is supposed to take place. The novel intentionally never says what year it takes place in. It's always phrased as the year when they finally immanentize the eschaton, which is a phrase meaning brought about the end of the world. But I happen to have a reasonable theory backed up with the support of what Mr. Wilson said outside of the text. For what year it's meant to take place in. I'm not going to say specifically, but I will say if you examine the details, it's labeled pretty clearly. I never put the numbers in there, but there are certain context clues that will let you know what year it is. Okay. But yes, it does take place in the 70s. That much I can say. Now we chased around a lot of terrible ideas about how to adapt this. Before we actually got started. And I'm very glad that I landed on doing a period piece as opposed to trying to take it out of its era, which was the original thought, and make it modern. Because of all the stuff you just said, which is, it's really fun to draw, you know, the old newspaper machines and the phone booths and like the old telephones, like all the mundane things become like kind of more interesting by placing it in the 70s.
Well, there's something I got to mention. I visited Mexico in the 70s, oddly enough. And when we were there, we saw the statue that you have in the book of Tlaloc.
Oh, nice.
Tlaloc the rain god. And yeah. I fell in love with the look of it. It's this kind of squarish kind of thing with like the hands have been cut off in the front and stuff like that. And we went all over Mexico looking for little representations, but here come two Americans, you know, me and the teacher, so begging for this Tlaloc thing, and they'd always jack the price hugely up when they saw we were Americans. And so I finally found one, and believe it or not, it is sitting on the table next to my bed still. Today, is there? I had it when I came back and I went to college. I had friends of mine who, when they didn't want it to rain, would put a cloth over the top of him so that it wouldn't rain, they hoped, and stuff like that. So it's, I still, there's something about that interesting thing that it's just, when I saw that, I went, oh man, he's standing down right next to my bed. So I was very intrigued. How did that, because you talk about, meanwhile, at the Museum of Anthropology in Chapultepec Park, where I've been, Mexico, how, what's he got to do with it, may I ask?
that is a very good question. And not being the one that put it there, cannot necessarily answer it. But I will tell you that statues of Tlaloc recur throughout the book in a way that I can't explain. And now you have your first, this is how this stuff gets you, is through coincidence. So the idea that you have a statue of that rain god and statues of that rain god occur throughout the novel is a perfect example of how people get into this stuff. It's just one weird little thing sticks out, and it's like a, it's like following the trail of breadcrumbs, and you just go, oh, that's interesting. And then it leads you to something else, leads you to something else. Why it's there, I have no idea. I knew it was a scene I wanted to keep because once I saw that statue, it looks like a Jack Kirby design to me almost. Yeah. And so I was like, I was like, that's got to be in. That's got to be in.
Now I got to ask too, one guy's name is, and I don't know if I can pronounce it, NKRU Nkrumah Fubar. Of course, Fubar.
Yeah, that's correct.
Fubar, of course, means certain something, but he's the grandchild of Kikuyu shaman, he's the grandchild of a shaman trying their hand at the family business, which apparently is music, because he's playing the trumpet out there. And by the way, we should mention your website. You have a website for all this where you have several of the pages from the first volume in there. Do you want to tell people how to get to the website?
Absolutely, yeah. So the website is talesofilluminatus.com. And we're actually, as much as this is indeed a print publication, it's also a weekly webcomic. So the whole thing is available to the patient to read a page every week. We post them every Thursday. So if you want to see what happens in the next page, come back on Thursday and the next Thursday and the Thursday after that. And eventually the whole thing will be available for free on the website.
So the whole thing is following Saul Goodman and Barney Muldoon as they track what goes on in the Illuminatus business, right? Is that what this is?
I wouldn't.
About?
Well, that's one of the strands. There is a, like maybe 12 other, like, you know how there's A stories and B stories? Well, in Illuminatus, you use up just about the whole alphabet in tracking your stories. So the Saul Goodman story is a big part of it, as is the George Dorn, but there's a lot of other offshoots to keep track of. It's kind of it's kind of interesting. It's almost like it's very influenced by James Joyce's Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake. It's almost like a Rashomon before Rashomon, in the sense that the characters all have different viewpoints and opinions about what's actually happening. And part of the mystery of the book is to figure out what is actually happening in the book and what this book is actually about. My son likes to comment, anytime I tell him anything from the book, he goes, this sounds like a completely different book. Every time you tell me about this book, it sounds like a completely different book. And that's the nature of the beast.
Wow. Okay. So you had to pay close attention to all these different strands, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Because there used to be a show on Fox that was called 24. And there were other shows like Lost that until there was background music, I would be looking and working on my computer. And all of a sudden music would start to come up and I'd turn away from the computer and watch the show because that's when something happened. And with the 24 was the opposite of that. I had to watch the whole thing. And sometimes things happened that meant something and sometimes they didn't mean anything at all. But I had to watch in order to get the whole business of the show. And it sounds like that's what this book is. It's going to require me to pay attention. And I like things that make me pay attention. So I like the sound of that. I'm going to be curious to see how this goes. I probably shouldn't ask this question, but does it have a conclusion? Is it a might there be more stories in the future of this that this book runs into? How does that go?
So there are actually several sequels and prequels and offshoots and stuff past the original trilogy that we do have permission to use. But I think that I'm going to try to weave that stuff throughout the book as opposed to like trying to sequelize it. I think I'm just going to put everything all in this one comic. And there, so it's both that this thing could go on for a really, really long time, but also it will end satisfyingly. Like there is, we are building towards something. Now, when that thing is constructed will largely depend on the success of the story and our kind of general momentum, I guess.
So as much as what they are looking into is a mystery, the book itself has other mysteries going on that we can follow and resolve.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, one of the things is that the book itself is an exploration of, a lot of secret societies and occult traditions and other kind of, it's like an alt history book in a way. Like it's the parts of history that were kind of in the margins. And so, but like I said, they made use of a professional research team to kind of build their fiction on a solid foundation of fact. And that's actually part of the literary technique that they're using here. So the idea is that you base the weirdest, wildest parts of the book in pure verifiable history, and then you weave your fiction. But then when you actually, like, if a reader goes and checks on some of this stuff, it's the weirdest parts that are true. And it almost, it's very disorienting when you go, oh, that was true? And so, you know, the talking dolphin may not be true, but some of the other wild stuff, you'll find in your standard references. And it's an idea. Part of the idea of the book was to kind of open people's minds in a way, to kind of broaden their capacity for what is and isn't possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to tell you, for a time, I was a Freemason up in the state of Maryland. I went through they, and I noticed how much of our language came out of the lodge and stuff like that. Give somebody the third degree means something, and there's whole bunches of other stuff that are part of that. And I did that for a while, and I can see it why people used to do it when there wasn't a lot to do, but now they're having a very difficult time getting people to become a Mason.
Yeah.
There's so much to do, and there's, you know, you used to have to memorize long things that you had to say to pass on from one degree to another. And, oh man, I just kind of, I got to the place where you could spend every night and every day doing Masonic things, and I just kind of said, well, that's enough for me. I think I'm going to get out.
Yeah. You ever see that movie, Gross Point Blank, with John Cusack?
No, I haven't seen that one.
It's Dan Aykroyd's trying to get John Cusack to join this, like, hitman group. They're both assassins, and he wants him to join a fraternity of assassins. And John Cusack, he's like, are there meetings? And he's like, yeah, there's meetings. He's like, no meetings. And he's just done. I've taken that as my motto as well. No meetings.
Yeah. Oh, believe me, it took a lot of my time, and I enjoyed it. You know, I had nothing better to do at that time. But I this is where I see the Venice of God's eye and stuff like that comes. A lot of that comes out of Masonic stuff. I always used to tell people, though, I said, because it's a secret society, and there are a couple of things that you can't really tell anybody. But I always tell people, if you knew what it was, you'd be bored. It's not.
You'd be so disappointed.
It's not a big deal. I'm sorry. It's just not. And all these people. Yeah. Then why isn't it public? Well, you kind of promise you're not going to tell people, and you want to live up to your word and stuff. But believe me, and all the stuff I heard about all the different the interaction of the different parts of the Masonic family and all that stuff made me laugh when I heard people say, it's, "Oh, if you only knew." Because they have the Order of the Eastern Star, which is a women's thing, and then somebody told me, well, the Eastern Star, because they're women, they have to satisfy, shall we say, the men in the lodge. I busted out laughing. I said, believe me, that nothing could be further from the truth than that. Yeah. Believe me. So all these kinds of things, I'm always interested in that. And I'm curious to see how this is all going to come together. Now, we should mention the timeline. It's just this. It says here that the Hidden Light first book will go to press on August 27th, and shipping worldwide will begin the first week of September. So there's not there's not a lot of time before this thing hits the people who pay for it.
That is correct. That is correct. We're looking to debut at the Small Press Expo on September 14th and 15th. So we're gonna get the books printed so that we can send it to the backers. And we're going to bring everything that we didn't pre-sell through the Kickstarter. We're going to bring to the Small Press Expo and see if we can get rid of the rest of them there. And then move on to issue number two.
Is that like in the D.C., Maryland area, that Small Press Expo?
Yeah, that's correct. It's in Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay. Because I went to a Small Press Expo in Ohio. And I enjoyed that really well. And I never got to the one, even though I lived in Maryland, I never got to go to the one that was in Bethesda. But that's interesting. So I wish you great luck with that. Are there other projects that you are working on? I'm sure this is probably keeping you quite busy, but are there other things that you work on that we should be aware of?
I did a one-man anthology series called Weird Comics. Todd and I did a book called Buddha Fart. Myself and another artist named Marcelino Bailo did a book called Agnosis. And I've done a bunch of like kind of one-shot comics. So I have a website, weirdoverse.com, that just has, you know, years and years and years worth of comics on there. And so yeah, I would say for the foreseeable future, I'm going to focus on Illuminatus. But we do have one more issue of a series before we turn it into a graphic novel. So the Buddha Fart series and the Agnosis series are actually one big graphic novel called Okie Dokie that I'm about 20 pages away from finishing. So that'll happen eventually. But I'm having a lot of fun with the Illuminatus stuff. I've kind of like just gotten into the groove of like what the thing is and what the work process is like. And so I think I'm going to keep that rolling for a while, but I've always got like, you know, six other things I'm juggling, but I'm trying to stay focused on one thing.
Well, it sounds like it's right up your alley. This thing is this,
yeah, absolutely,
just the thing you like. So it's kind of fun to see this. I'm always interested in mysteries and stuff like that. I love murder mysteries because I like, fortunately, at the end of the hour, you know what's going on. Many mysteries, you don't know that. So I'm always intrigued by those kinds of things. But so the first one's going to be out right after the campaign is over. When is the second one going to come around? Is that going to still be this year or is it going to be next year?
It'll probably be early next year. It'll probably be, I'm going to guess, late December, early January is when we'll start the campaign. And then probably see print probably in like February or so. But I think according to our schedule, I think the serialization of issue one stops around mid-November. And so actual new pages will start around then, and then we'll try to hit a winter release for issue number two. I'm guessing we're probably going to do 2 to 3 issues a year, unless we hit some sort of crazy success and we can expedite things. But I think just going at our natural pace, it'll be about 2-3 issues a year.
Okay, now there's 3, right, in the whole series? Is that what we're aiming at?
Yeah, right, so there's 3 books in the trilogy. Though really, all my encounters with it and the way it's published now, it's just one giant 800-page-long book. So the idea is to cover each of the 3 books and then publish those as like trade paperbacks or graphic novels. So the idea is you release it first on a weekly schedule as a webcomic. Then you release it on a like maybe almost quarterly schedule as a individual comic. And then you release it as a collection of graphic novels. And then you release it as like a giant omnibus. That's kind of my vision for the publishing cycle.
Okay, because that's a good way to do it, because I hear several things. There's a book I know, because I'm a Batman guy. There's a Batman, Wayne Family Adventures, it's called. They put out like every week a page or two, a chapter. And then once they get the whole book, they're in the fifth book where it just came out. And it's kind of like what happens in between the big adventures in the comics. This is their family life.
Kind of. I like that. Yeah.
And they do that just like you do. They put a thing out on a weekly basis. And then when they get enough to make a book, they put the book out. And so that sounds like a successful way to do it.
I was really captured by the old Little Nemo in Slumberland strips. Hmm. Have you ever seen those?
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of just one elaborate, beautifully illustrated strip a week. And it just seemed like such a nice schedule for both reader and creator to just, you know, because I'm a high school teacher in my regular time. But I can do a page a week, no problem. Now in the summer, I'm doing, you know, 4 or 5 pages a week. But you know, when I'm working, a page a week is a very reasonable thing. And so if I set that as our pace, it's something that I could keep up for years and years and years. And we could actually see this thing grow bit by bit, little bit by little bit. And that's the goal, just like little incremental progress. That's right. So that was part of the idea with the Kickstarter, was just to set a nice little modest goal. Let's try to secure our the amount to publish a decent set of the books. That's all I was looking for. And I think that's something that we, you know, it's a good starting point just to grow it forward little bit by little bit.
Cool. Well, based on the success so far, again, let me say the project will be funded. Of course, you've reached your goal already by Friday, August 23rd at 11:43 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And see, there's stuff already that there's the graphic in the top that harkens back to my Masonic days. There's these pillars and there's like letters on the bottom. There's a J and a B and there's a moon and a half moon or a quarter moon or something on the top. So these kind of things always puzzle me. Why are they the way they are? I can't help it. I want to know those things. So I might have to get into
it. Absolutely. And then just to throw out why the Masonic stuff is tied in with the Illuminati stuff is the one of the original versions of a group of people calling themselves the Illuminati was Adam Weishaupt in Bavaria in the late 1700s. And what it was a secret society within Freemasonry. Hmm. So you had the Freemasons, which were a secret society, and then you had a smaller group within Freemasonry that was the Illuminati. So it was a secret society within a secret society.
Hmm. Oh boy. See, when I went through the Masons and I went all the way up, I did both sides. There was a religious side and a secular side. I went up through both of them, got as far as I could, at least I know, and both of them, and I found it really interesting. There's so much interesting involved in that, but I understand why they did that, because they had nothing to do back in those days in the nighttime. And stuff.
Right.
How they spent their nights doing these things, but I can't do that anymore, but it still interests me. I'm still fascinated by it. So do you have social media accounts if people want to follow you that they can follow you on?
Yeah, absolutely. I am RGC777 on Twitter. I am Weirdoverse on Instagram. And I am BobbyCampbell.bluesky.social on the Blue Sky one. That about covers where I am.
Okay, because I belong to about 8 social media things.
I know.
I'm trying desperately to get the word out about the podcasts and stuff like that. So I saw everyone that comes around, I think I might get a few more listeners. I go in there and try to do it. My Sunday mornings are spent after the podcast comes up. I'm on social media for a while, going everyone that I can, trying to put it up. So I'll try to get the word out about these good things. So I've got one more question. Are you going to put this whole thing together as an 800-page graphic novel at some point?
To be honest, that is the goal. And not only that, I've actually been so we're doing these as magazine-sized editions. Mm. I was really taken by – have you ever seen the old Harvey Pekar American Splendor books?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they were magazine sized, and right. I've been buying up all the issues of that I can find, and I just love that size for a comic. But then even beyond that, we've been drawing them twice up, so we've been drawing them at like 16x20 or whatever the twice up is. So I would love to do. Have you ever seen the giant Jack Kirby Fourth World books?
Oh,
like
yeah.
Like the ones that are like as big as a coffee table. That is my ultimate dream. My ultimate dream is to have an omnibus version with all 800 pages double-sized in one of those giant block-like things. Very impractical, very unlikely to happen, but it's good to have goals to shoot for. And you know, so we're planning for success. We're drawing the book twice size to eventually get to that point. Whether we actually will or not, you know, who knows how lucky we get, but that's the goal.
Well, I hope so. And based on the fact you've already met your goal and you still got till the 23rd to get more support, I would say that you're on a good start. And again, it's Tales of Illuminatus! Number one, The Hidden Light. I didn't even ask what The Hidden Light was all about, but I assure you, if you read the book, you find out more about those kinds of things.
Absolutely.
There's always mysteries in these good things. Well, all I can tell you is this is a very fascinating thing. It intrigues me tremendously. I got to be able to back this and get into it some, Bobby, because it just looks like a fascinating read. I love something that draws me in and pulls me out of my real life into another world for a while. Sometimes I just like to do that. And this looks like a great thing.
And now I have a good reason to keep the Tylock stuff going. So you'll see him around.
Oh, good. Well, I'd like to see it. Tylock is one of my very favorite. Like I said, I still have his little statue next to me. I finally found one that I liked, and I've been desperately trying to make sure it doesn't get broken. So it's clay. It was like they put it like a clay thing, and they molded it and stuff like that. But Tylock, I always liked something about the look of him, and something about, I just always was intrigued by it. Anyway, enough about Tylock. If you want, it's T-L-A-L. Let me spell it just in case, because the internet is unforgiving. T-L-A-L-O-C. If people want to actually look him up, he's Mexican mythology and stuff like that. So it's kind of fun. But Bobby, it's just great to talk with you. I hope I get to do it again. Maybe when the second one comes around, we'll talk some more and see how things are progressing with you. But again, it's Tales of Illuminatus, The Hidden Light. It's number one. So be sure to get that on Kickstarter. And for the last time, the project will be funded if it reaches its goal, which it already has, by Friday, August 23rd, 11:43 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So, Bobby, much success, and I can't wait to see more from you in the future. I think this is a great idea. Lots and lots of fun.
Thank you so much, Wayne. This was awesome. I really appreciate you having me on, and I would love to come back again.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support this show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.